Thank you, Jim. Look, thank you for the invitation to present. It's not often that I get the chance to enjoy the jet lag and the long haul, but it's always fun when you get here. It's all about the destination in this particular case. I'd like to talk a little bit about our recent experiences using the active optical sensing from the air. We're keen on doing it from the air over many of our fields because we like to get into crops that are not amenable to vehicular scanning. And also, we're doing a lot of work with pastures as well. That photo I was showing off because that cost me a slab of beer. I had a deal with my guys that if anyone could give me a photo of an aircraft and actually be able to see the sensor in the belly there with the light coming out, as you can see if you peer carefully at it just behind the nose, then there's a beer in it. I'm good. So look, I'm from the University of New England, the Australian version, that is. I represent a group called the Precision Agriculture Research Group. Now, there's a couple of really useful exports that have come out of this country. Unfortunately, Buddy isn't one of them. And why? Because our roos love it. In fact, the place is full of piss roos most of the time. Now, I've been asked 5 times in the 2 days that I've been here, am I an Aussie, which is scored twice, or am I a Kiwi, which scores 3 times. I thought I'd give you a brief geography lesson. In order to make this entertaining, it's always good to take the mick out of your mates. We Australians and New Zealanders have a fantastic relationship. We are two different countries. We are separated by the ditch, or the Tasman Sea. Now, Australia has developed somewhat a bit of a reputation through history as enjoying shooting every animal on our coat of arms. There's nothing quite as satisfying as a roo shoot, though nowadays it's not quite so politically correct. We share that with the Kiwis, in fact. They've got quite a history with shooting everything on their coat of arms as well. Now, in terms of terminology, there's a few things that separate us apart, though, that we don't have in common. For a start, we generally call a spade, so we have these things called eskies, and they are clearly labelled as eskies, and we call them eskies. The Kiwis call them chili bins. We call these things thongs, the Kiwis, and I believe most of the my American friends call them flip-flops. I guess I have seen around the web that there are better versions of thongs out there. Now, we have an issue with speed signs and road advisory signs. In Australia, we have speed humps. The Kiwis like judder bars. Now, fair enough, I think it's quite empirical. What you see is what you get. But of course, like all good college kids, it's always good to go poaching road signs and putting them on your college door or your dorm door. So, you know, I presume these signs are used as a tantalising suggestion of what's on offer inside. We certainly condition our signs by saying no, we offer more than just a speed hump. And the Kiwis obviously think it's worth a slow judder bar. Okay. And just to wrap up the issues about the Australians and the Kiwis, yes, we are different. We do love a good grudge match. There are 3 main sports that we like to compete against the Kiwis with. The first one is cricket. Well, this year round, it's 1-0 as far as it's concerned. The other one is the netball. We gave them a good caning this year, so it's 2-0. I don't think I really want to talk about that one. Okay, now to the business of the day, biomass monitoring tools. Thanks to Kyle. We don't need to spend too much time on the theory of what's going on. I mean, ultimately, our angle of attack in using these active sensors is that we can use them by day or by night. They have their own light source, so that means the illumination conditions, the ambient illumination conditions, don't affect the measurement, and that's really important. When you're deploying these sensors, for example, in an aircraft, you don't need to worry about whether or not it's a cloudy or sunny day. In fact, you don't even need to worry about whether it's daylight. We have low-flying aircraft, our top dressing aircraft, which we bolt these things on, and they fly low-level crop dressing transects at night, and they use the resistance of the crop on the wheel as a judge of how close they are to the crop. Now, like most of us here that are using active sensors, we've done a lot of groundwork and a lot of calibration work in pastures and in crops, and really our ability to carry these sensors around the paddock is limited by the size of the vehicle you put them on. We like carrying as many sensors as we can when we're out field surveying, so we're always taking an EM38 out there for inferring soil moisture, at least gross textural differences in the soil. I'm always guarded about what EM38 will tell you. But likewise, we're always watching the canopy either in the crop or the pastures. Generally, you'll get good calibrations. When I mean good, when you look at the errors of prediction of the calibrators, they're generally in line with standard eyeball estimates, certainly with pastures. But they are time consuming. You've got to spend time out in the field, and you've got to spend a lot of time out if you're riding transects. For example, in our pasture work, we've got a lot of Australian growers who want to know exactly what pasture they've got at certain times. It may be to advise on rotating herds on and off paddocks. Some of our growers during the peak pasture growth season will have rotation rates or frequencies of 4 days. And they are really keen on tracking their biomass, how it evolves over time. And in fact, there are now cheat cards which are available for certain pasture species, certainly in a monoculture sense, which can be used to very quickly convert active optical sensing data into some sort of measure of pasture biomass. There's even an SMS service. If you type in your NDVI, you'll get back a pasture biomass assessment based on the details of what you sowed, when you sowed it, and the local area you're in. The active sensors are very useful for calibrating satellite-based products. In Australia, we have a commercial, for example, pasture assessment tool called Pastures from Space. It's derived from the MODIS satellite, which has a 6-hectare pixel. Twice daily overpasses, you get a weekly product or a weekly map of calibrated NDVI to biomass, assuming, again, that the pasture species has been calibrated for, or at the very least you get high, medium, low growth, and indeed growth rates. And what the active optical sensing approach is useful for on the ground in the hands of the farmers is to calibrate that product, that NDVI product from satellite, to something that matters to them. And also, there's a push in Australia to look at this whole notion about, well, if you want to map something in a field to get a sense of the average and the variance and even to some surrogate indication of the spatial variation, can there be truncated transects, some canary transects that could be used that could effectively mimic the gross attributes of the field? And that's an area that's of growing interest, because ultimately you have a sensor on the back of a ute or on the bull bar of your car. Then if it's possible to drive in one gate and follow some truncated transect on the way out the other gate, because that's often the best you get from your pasture managers or your stockmen, then it will be handy to get a bit of an idea of what the variability of the pasture is and the values are while you're on the go. This is an interesting slide. It's interested us, and I noticed that Kyle spent some time on this in his earlier presentation, that when you're looking at active optical sensing, you've got to bear in mind the condition of the leaves in terms of any water. Moisture, droplets on the leaf or a water cutting on the leaf will affect them. So if you're out running these sensors early in the morning or in the towards the evening, then or even after an irrigation cycle, then if you do have water on the plants, you will affect the values of the sensor response. And as you've seen, Kyle spent a fair bit of time on his own work in his garage lab. Now, there are a couple of physical challenges about getting these sensors on aircraft. For example, we've done a lot of work with our good friend David Boundy, who runs Super Air, which is an aerial top dressing company in Armidale. He's done a lot of geophysical survey work with sensors, and so when we approached him about 3 years ago about bolting one of these crop circles on his plane, we gave him the requirements that it needed to be within 6 metres of the deck at any time, because beyond 6 metres, of course, the signal-to-noise ratio drops to the point where you get no measurable ratio. Dave wasn't concerned about that. He's flown a lot of airborne radiometric surveys at very low level. In fact, he prides himself on wiping the most sensors that you give him off his plane, if you give him the chance. He suggested that he would do that to me as well. If I gave him a sensor, he'd be quite happy to have a go at wiping it off. The wingtips of his aircraft are all shiny, are all silver, and all the paint's been worn off, and you understand why when you see him tilting and dipping his wings in the paddock. So we rose to that challenge, in fact. We put a bet on that if we put a sensor on his plane and he couldn't wipe off in a season, then he'd buy me a carton of black rats, which are effectively premixed rum and colas. It's quite a treat up home. What I did was, when I talked to his maintenance engineers, we designed and bolted on directly behind his fixed nose wheel, so if he was going to wipe it off, he wasn't going to be able to land either. His response to that was to simply wear his motorcycle helmet when he wore it, when he flew it. But suffice to say, I have won the bet. basically, the conditions that we operate these sensors under is we fly whatever the top-dressing aircraft flies. In a cotton field, for example, we're talking 20-metre transects in a race track pattern. And here's a trial we recently did in the end of December 4 years ago, 3 years ago, in skip row sorghum. And what we did was, at the time we conducted the airborne survey flying these 20-metre transects, we also commissioned just a standard airborne multispectral image from one of the local service providers. And what you have here is the crop circle survey, effectively with an interpolated surface put over it, just through kriging on a 10-metre grid. And this is the airborne image. And you can basically see that the zones are pretty well the same in the two of them. There is an area down here where the airborne image doesn't agree with the crop circle map. That gave us some area of concern. Perhaps it was the effect of lifting the nose of the aircraft and coming around for the next run on the racetrack. But in fact, when we look very closely at the data, it wasn't an artifact in the active sensor data at all. In fact, that is a seam line where the commercial producer stitched two successive images together and didn't quite get their bidirectional reflectances together. Now, if that were to be used, those simple ratio or NDVI values were to be used as part of a prescription algorithm, then clearly there's a small section of your field which would be getting the wrong dose. So the one thing you get with your active sensor is you don't get those sort of problems associated with, for example, mosaicing multiple images together for very large fields. Of course, when you're flying transects at 4 metres above the deck, that really limits you operationally to a laser-leveled field in the flat country, to be sure. We contacted Kyle, having had some a success with using his crop circle, and suggested or asked him if he could help us and put together a system that would allow us to fly much higher off the ground. And Kyle did that. He developed his Raptor almost overnight. I've never seen a guy move so quick. The Raptor sensor is effectively a crop circle on steroids. It's got much, much higher illuminance from the sensor, much brighter, and much more sensitive electronics in the belly. And whilst I somehow made a typo there, I'd love to fly it at 500 metres above the deck. What we did find was that you could deploy this sensor between 10 and 55 metres above the deck and get a good measurable signal response in the NDVI simple ratio. So we conducted a trial with that. In fact, what we did was just over a year ago, we did a trial in wheat where we actually had an on-ground crop circle sensor going. Now, we didn't want to waste our time with utes, so my technical officer, Derek Schneider, who loves motorcycle riding as well, was quite happy to wear a GPS on his back and flog through the paddock on his motorbike. And it's quite a sight to see when you see a guy doing a wheelie with a crop circle pointing horizontally and the GPS antenna dipping down in the crop. He quite enjoyed winding me up with that. He did a survey of his paddock with his on-ground crop circle, and then we flew the Raptor over at three different altitudes, 50, 100 and 150 feet above the ground. And as you can see, just in the visible maps alone, there is very little difference between them at any altitude, and indeed between them and the on-ground sensor. That little red spot, which is on the ground survey, disappears here but reappears in the final altitude. That is a small 2 metre by 2 metre patch of ground that was exposed by just cutting away all the crop. And the reason we haven't seen in those two is that the aircraft alignment, we flew on pre-programmed tram lines, trying to make sure we did exactly the same transects. Obviously, a little bit of tilt or roll in the aircraft, and it just happened to miss that little 2 metre blot as it was whipping through at 100 and something knots. When you apply the statistics to it, there was absolutely no significant difference whatsoever in any of the survey data. I think I'm going to get woofed at, Jim, is that right? We just completed a sugar trial. Now, sugar's a challenging crop. We've just completed it literally a few weeks back. As you can see, the sugar canopies can grow up to 2 metres high, and you simply can't get ground sensors in there. But a friend of mine was doing a project up in the Bundaberg region where he was commissioning satellite imagery, in fact getting satellite imagery every 3 weeks for the whole sugar growing season. I got wind of that and said, well, look, can we sneak our Raptor up and have a sniff around at the same time? And for the whole growing season, he succeeded in getting two satellite images entirely. That was all he got. There was only two clear view days in the whole 8-month growing season where he got satellite imagery. We collected Raptor data every time we flew up there because, as you can see, it doesn't matter whether it's overcast or, as I said, even where the sun's out. And as you can see, just visually, there's good correlation between, for example, the Raptor data on the two that we did overlap and the Ikonos satellite data that they achieved. So I guess the message I'm trying to hit home with these active sensors is that, you know, from my experience, when I've spent years playing with satellite and airborne imaging systems, I'm really enjoying the flexibility of these sort of active sensors now that we can get them off the ground high enough. And there's another issue with remotely sensed data, be it certainly with satellites, not quite so much with airborne because they're a little closer to the ground, and that is you've got to bear in mind that satellite systems are giving you top of atmosphere reflectances, if they are calibrated to that, or radiometric units certainly, from which the indices are devised. Whereas, you know, the active sensors are giving you the actual values. And you'll always find, we always find certainly, that, and I've used MODIS satellite as an example, that that satellites tend to overestimate the NDVI values. So if we want to push, you know, remotely sensed products towards algorithms to define nitrogen prescriptions, for an example, we've got to bear in mind that there is a difference in the measurements because of the atmospheric effects, which can be corrected with atmospheric transfer models, to be sure. But they're only as good as the local data that you've got, in, for example, aerosol content and so forth. Just to give you a little insight into what our group's playing with back at UNE in Armidale, and Kyle's picked up on the same thread and probably moved a little quicker than us, there's a lot more information you can get out of a crop if you're looking at reflectance and some measure of geometry, for example, the canopy height. I've got a young PhD student, Mick Schaefer, who's almost finished his PhD, which basically means he's now starting to do some work. He's taken a reflectance sensor, red near-infrared sensor, and he's also mixed it with an optical ranging device as well. He's taken two approaches to the optical ranging. One is using that very inverse square law that Kyle talked about in his earlier presentation. And what he's got, the approach we're taking is you just have two offset detectors by about 50 centimetres, and you use the inverse square law as you go, the difference between the return signal at those two slightly different distances. Works very neatly for small distances, around from half a metre up to about 2 metres, and then breaks down. The other approach is a position-sensitive detector, where basically you have a linear array detector and the position of the reflected spot through a lens that's picked up from the target gives you an output voltage that responds to the position of the spot. With a bit of optics, you can set it up so that the further you're away from a target, the more the spot is offset along that detector. And you get a much better response over a much larger range. So this so-called three-dimensional NDVI that Kyle has mentioned, I think is a very important development in those active sensing technology. We're looking forward to seeing it come out. Some of our own preliminary results, I sent Mick out in the car, that's as close as I'd get him to a plane, until he gives me his thesis. Where we've just simply driven along some crops and we've just been collecting, you know, the NDVI, for example, data from the active sensor and the height. And he's got all these various stats to show that there is a good level of explanation, certainly vastly improved level of explanation when you factor both in to measurements, for example, of a biomass, above ground biomass, and indeed for nitrogen, as we saw some results of Kyle's as well. One of the questions we're getting now from our growers that are seeing this technology used is, well, look, it's great if we can fly these things over crops and come up with NDVI maps, which we could maybe use to help us in our fertiliser application. Well, can we actually use the data as it's streaming into the belly of the plane to control the application while we're doing it? In other words, we don't want to do two flights. We'd like to do the measurement and the application in one hit. And, of course, the challenge we've got is that the signal that's coming in from these optical sensors are a little bit noisy. And they judder around very quickly at high frequency, which means it's very hard to actuate a device on and off as you go. And for example, a little calculation we did just looking at the noise in the sensor derived by flying over skip rows in sorghum essentially means that you're trying to judder on and off your applicator in the belly of the plane with a magnitude of application that ranges from zero fertilised application to maximum. So, you know, the trick is to get the noise out of the signal if you want to use it to drive it. The trick is it's not about just filtering out the noise of a one-dimensional signal, because when we work in fields, we work on zones. And really, in order to create your zones for your application prescription, you've got to have the information all in front of you beforehand. It's a retrospective approach. And the geostatistical techniques that are used to create these zones are well-founded techniques, but require the full two-dimensional suite of raw data before you can create those zones. So we took the tack of, well, let's develop a dynamic aerial survey algorithm that actually looks at the instantaneous string of numbers coming in the belly of the plane as you're flying linear transects, but predicts a two-dimensional zone map out in front of the aircraft. In other words, you apply two-dimensional statistical tools to effectively a linear string of data coming in the aircraft. And the trick is to break it down to a couple of zones, so perhaps high, medium, low, something simple for actuation, but also to do it far enough in front of the aircraft that you've got a couple of seconds to predict what you need so that the actuation system effectively conditions itself ready for the application. So you want to smooth out the data, if you like, but on a whole paddock scale based on that string of numbers that are coming in one dimensions into the aircraft. So we need a two-dimensional geostatistical process, the same that you'd apply to a complete paddock. And you want to do it far enough ahead so that you've got the time. And I've got a little demo to show you how this technique works. Okay, here is a process. So here you have the aircraft flying a transect. What you see on the right there is the actual two-dimensional map forecast out in front of the aircraft based on that linear string of data that just went in behind it in that previous pass. As you can see, and over here I've actually got the difference. We know what the full NDVI map of this paddock is because we actually did it. We've already done it. We're just now rerunning the trial in time sequence. This error here is the difference between the full paddock NDVI map and the actual map that we've predicted ahead of the aircraft based on that ever-accumulating string of data behind the aircraft. So as the aircraft moves along, the more transects it flies, the better the zonal map looks ahead of the plane over the whole paddock. But at the end of the day, all we want to do is predict the zones in a line ahead of the aircraft, but again, using that two-dimensional approach to get that two-dimensional zonality. So basically, we're looking at an error in NDVI of about 0.2 NDVI units. Now, this is a paddock that we've hit blind. In other words, we're coming in from one end and we're simply moving from right to left as we go. So clearly that's the most challenging process or scenario to offer up, this particular statistical process. But it is a very powerful statistical process. It only takes about 5 seconds. I've accelerated here in this movie, but 5 seconds at the end between when you complete a line transect like that to predict the zones ahead of the aircraft for the next one and arm up the actuation. Now, 5 seconds is much less than the time required to execute a full turn, teardrop turn to come back on your racetrack. So that gives you a bit of a sense of where this technology is going. And as you can see, for example, in this blind scenario here, we've just hit the field cold and we're building it from right to left, it takes us about 25 transects before we've collapsed the errors of the field zones down to virtually zero. In fact, they're less than 0.1%. And you've got to bear in mind, apart from Jim's phone talk barking at me, that there are 50 transects in that field, so just under half the field is required to be done to get it down to zero. But as you can see, the errors are collapsing. If you take an approach where you fly the aircraft over a field and do the cross spaghetti, well, that's the diamonds there. You can see they're quite large and coming down. But if you that's a plane spaghetti, the one we just flew. But if you take a situation that you fly an aircraft over the field and do a quick crisscross from corner fence to corner fence and then start, the errors collapse in the statistical forecasting very quickly. And in fact, if you do the crossed field followed by racetracks, it collapses after 2 transects to about less than 0.1%, which is extraordinary when you think of it. But that's the power of doing that. So there is definitely an opportunity here to take this technology towards real-time actuation control, yet using a full paddock view, if you like, as you go. So as far as my own group's concerned, and the growers we're working with, we're very keen to push this a little farther, using the active sensors as part of the prescription application itself. We've got some partners that are really keen on getting these active sensors in the bellies of UAVs. For example, using UAVs to do high-altitude imaging, but then zooming down and doing a one-line transect run through a field or a collection of fields with a crop circle underneath it, to allow you to come up with some calibration transects, if you like, to convert your digital numbers in your imaging system to real reflectance values. And then, as Kyle's mentioned in his talk, and certainly exhibits a bit of prescience there, or maybe just pure ass, we're keen as well on moving into the three-dimensional NDVI. So thank you for your attention on that. And just to let you know that as an institution at home, we've actually developed up Australia's first and currently only postgraduate course in precision agriculture. It's a graduate certificate. It's badged. Now, it's nice to have a bit of a brag about that, to be sure. But the pin-up girl on this course is indeed active optical sensing, because as far as Australian agriculture is concerned, as a sensor modality, that's probably the one that's really captured our images, our industry's imagination, and creating a lot of interest. Thank you very much.
Thank you. 2 questions. First.
What was your source for the MODIS NDVI?
We have our own collection system. That data came from... We have our own collection system. That data comes from the Western Australia Land Information Centre, the Landgate, and they have their own downlink facilities.